So thank you, George, for probably the weirdest introduction I've ever had. So the title of my talk is User Interfaces and How People Think. I'm really happy to see all of you here. I'm aware that this is maybe a tangent or a different way into what you guys really focus on with Unix-related stuff, but I think there's some connections. So this will also be kind of high level, and I actually won't really focus anything on actual user interfaces, but more about how I as a designer approach solving problems for people, and hopefully it'll be a little bit fun. So it'll go pretty quickly, and then I'd like to go back through it and open it up to questions. But I'd like to run through it once, and then we can jump around. So if that sounds good, I'll just go through it. So my background, as George mentioned a little bit, is in user experience design, which is a focus on people, not technology. But everything has technology in it these days, even if it's, you know, not the actual software that you're making or something like that. Information architecture, which is a fancy way of talking about structuring information into logical groups and relationships, and if anybody's done data modeling, I'm sure you have, it's a lot like that, only often in the way people think, not the way a system thinks. Ethnographic research is a fancy way of saying, talking to users, not like a marketing focus group where you say, you know, if I made this, would you buy it? People nod their head and say, yeah, I'd buy it. And you put it out in the store and nobody buys it and they wonder why. So ethnographic research is about going into the world and watching people do what they do. And then you'll see where people struggle. And when you see an area where somebody struggles, you can say, oh, there's an opportunity to design something better that makes their life easier. A great example of that is, who has an OXO Good Grips can opener? You know what that is. Those Good Grips can openers with the squishy handles? Okay, George has one. So some of you might recall can openers used to be just stamped metal, and they're really hard to grip, and you have to crunch your hand and do all this complex, you know, it's painful. So this company, Smart Design, made a new can opener with squishy handles for people with arthritis to make it easier to open a can. This is like the most simple example of, based on watching people struggle with something, they're like, oh, okay, what if we made it squishy? It was so successful now that they make all kinds of things like that, and everybody likes it. So that's an example of that. The other example that's very common is the suitcases with wheels and a handle. It was originally made for stewards or flight attendants on airplanes because they travel more than everybody else. Everyone else is lugging around, you know, regular luggage. So popular that now everybody does it, we don't even think about it. So that's what comes out of doing sessions like that. And then finally, business strategy, because no matter what you make, there's got to be some reason to do it, either to make money or to add value in people's lives or anything like that, and technology helps you execute on that. So if you're in a technology business, then that's very recursive. So that's me. And then I work for a consulting firm called Sapient. We are a business and technology consulting firm, which also spends a lot of time in the interactive space, a lot of web sites, but also software and back-end integration. And 60% of the 6,000 employees we have are in India. So we are one of the first companies to really take on the global distributed development or delivery. It's a little different than outsourcing, per se, but you know, we just have the team everywhere. I used to work for Sprint, which I used to be proud of, and if you look at their stock price now, I'm not so proud of it. However, when I was there, I was a sysadmin for Sprint.com. And Sprint, at the time, was a Fortune 50, so they were really big. And we had geo-redundant clustered Solaris environments across multiple locations in the U.S., and I was the guy that they would call at 2 a.m., which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, when things break. I also actually designed a lot of the website work for them along with that, but I did what I did because I was able to kind of see the holistic picture and bring it all together for them. So this is a timeline of what it looked like back in the old days from the dot-com era and then what it looks like more closer to now. It's a little out of date. Other things I did while I was there was I designed PictureMail, which everyone has a camera phone now and you can send pictures to your friends. Sprint was the first carrier to do this in the U.S. after Japan and NTT Docomo. And after voice calls, this service was their highest stream of revenue, so it was very successful for them. But if you think of it not as the GUI, as George was referring to, or the little menus and all that stuff on the phone, but the way it works of, okay, I take a picture, and then who do I want to send it to, and then I send it, and what if I want to send it to multiple people, or what if I don't want to send it to their phone, but I want to send it to be printed, wouldn't that be nice? I figured out how all of that works, with a large team, of course, it wasn't just me. And then finally, one of the things we did at Sprint that was unique that I think is relative here is we were very quantitative about our products that we put out in the world, and we would actually measure how usable and a product was and how satisfied the customers were with it, and we could tell if they were really dissatisfied that we needed to change the design or the product offering and make a new version of it, and that could actually correlate to how much money the company made. Usability is the definition of that. I have no idea how much this crowd knows, so I'll just put it out there. If something doesn't work the way you expect it, the way you think about how it should work, then it's broken. Even if technically it works, cognitively it doesn't match. So I'll talk about that a little bit more in a second. And at the basic level, if something's broken cognitively and it doesn't work, you won't use it. It'll sit on the shelf. And you'll buy something else. And so for people to adopt the thing you make, whether you're creating a website or creating a product like this little clicker that I have in my hand, if it doesn't work, then you'll go out of business. So this bell curve here that's up on the screen also says in the traditional world of mass market selling is there's the largest volume of people in the middle, and that's when you try to design for the masses. You also have examples where that doesn't apply, like Amazon.com, where they have everything possible and they sell to many, many niche markets, and the web has facilitated that, and that's a different conversation. But that's this tail at the end. So that's another conversation. Okay, so that's a good segue to talk about briefly how people think, which is also how people learn. But once they stop learning, then they're in a certain stage of their thinking. So I'd like to share a model about how people make decisions. Okay. This comes from the discipline of cognitive human factors, which is how people think. It's also based on cognitive psychology, which is, there is the human factor of, physical. If I can't walk through the door, that's a problem. Or if I hit my head, that's a problem. So things in, we create our world to match our human body and size. And I can't reach the projector to switch over to my computer. That's a problem. And then you create new things like remotes, which we don't have for that. But what happens is that there are levels to how you understand things. And this is what we want to know when we decide what to make. The example, and I'm always going to try to tie this back to the world of Unix, but so my mom would see the command line and go, "Good God, what is that?" Right? I have no idea what to do. But when she sees Google, which is basically another version of the command line interface, she goes, "Oh, I know what to do, but it's only one task, it's search." And so they are very successful at that one task, and all the other tasks they try to shove into the same interface don't really work as well. And that's why their stock is falling, like you mentioned before. But that's one level, but for us, we'd be like, okay, great, I know that I can do awk and grep and dip and blah, 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 and I can have a field day, and it's very fast for me. So the first stage when people are learning something or they know nothing about what they're interacting with, is called knowledge-based behavior, and what that means is they have to study it to understand it and think about it because they don't recognize it. So the first one here is if the sensory input, which is the geeky way to say, your senses, what you see, you smell, hear, feel, are the way you understand your world around you, those are what gives you a formation of the features of the thing. So, the you touch the book and you can tell that the book is a book without opening your eyes, because it's a paperback book. You just know. You can walk around in the dark at night and figure it out because you have senses. So, but you don't recognize what it is. So you have to identify it by studying it. And then you have to go all the way around this loop of the boxes in red. And then you have to make a decision on what you want to do with it, which is called a task decision. And then you see there's goals pointed in, so everything has to be goal-oriented. So the way to think about that is, if I don't have a reason to be here, I'm not going to be here. If I'm not trying to do something, I'm not going to open up that application on the computer or go to that website. Or, you know, if I don't want tea, I'm not going to boil water. Then you have to plan. So if you're trying to make tea, you have to think, well, what do I have to do? There's rules and procedures to get there. And then once you learn those, then you can remember them and store them. And then finally, it becomes automatic because you've done enough times, you just know what to do. So let's characterize this, because this is pretty dry. So knowledge-based behavior is like Pan's Labyrinth. It's really scary, full of anxiety. It can change on you, and you don't know what changed. And you don't know if there's a monster after you because you don't know where you are or what you're looking at. It's very anxiety-stricken. So when you see people learning a computer for the very first time, you know, they do silly stuff like use the CD tray for a cup holder, which is kind of going away, but where they always store all their files on the desktop because they don't understand the concept of folders and all those things that the Mac introduced or made popular back in the day, which are very common now. But for someone just starting, like my 9-year-old niece, she's really good at browsing the web, but she's really bad at opening up applications because all she's ever done is use the web. So the second stage of this is called rule-based behavior. And not unlike the first stage, you're not an expert yet, but you start to recognize things because you've seen it before. You're no longer, you're no longer a virgin, right? So you recognize things, and then you can associate the task that you want to do with the thing you recognize, or the state of the thing you recognize. And then you remember what to do, so there's the stored task rule, and then you do it. So it's shorter, which means it's faster. The analogy here is, the first time you go through, browsing directories in your terminal or your command line, you know, you learn the commands, and once you learn the commands, you can kind of fumble around and move around, but you're not just hammering through them very quickly because it's something that you kind of know, or you don't realize that there's a faster way to do it because you haven't been exposed to it. So it's kind of mundane or mediocre. You're okay, but you're not great. So the characterization of that, office states, right? They're not particularly good, but they're not terrible. They don't really enjoy what they do because they're not passionate or no reason to get motivated about it, and they generally kind of hate it. Like most tasks or chores that you have to do in life, like, I have to do this. I have to do my laundry. I have to go to work. When you really like something and get excited about it and learn everything you can, you move to the final stage, which is called skill-based behavior. And this is basically the Michael Jordan phase, or I'll have another characterization in a second. But you know something so well, you don't even have to think about it. It becomes muscle memory. You don't have to think to walk, right? That's the physical human factor example again. You don't have to think to do half the things you do. In fact, you can't even remember how you got to work in the morning. You just do it, right? Unless you're like me and you travel everywhere and every time you go to a new city, you're screwed. You have to fumble around and get lost and turn around and go the other way. So you go straight from teacher formation. There are signs instead of goals. And you just say, okay, I know what to do, and I do it. So then there you go. The characterization of this would be the Matrix, which is a little bit overused, but it's actually very relevant for this because at some point, Neo achieved the total mastery over his world and his domain such that he could manipulate it and change it. That's this expert mode that's skill-based. Some of you are probably really, really good at what you do, and you may be here. Some of you, or sometimes myself, I think I'm really good, and then I meet someone else that's really good. And I'll go, oh, you know what? I got to go back. Because now I've been exposed to something that I thought I knew, but I didn't actually know. You could argue that the original Matrix movie, this is from Reloaded, which, whatever, but it was interesting to people because it was the story of Neo going through these stages of learning and knowing. So you can look at this both from a, how do I make things that I make in the world to solve problems for me so that this learning curve is lower, or you can also look at it as, this is the way everybody learns everything, and it takes time. And depending on how complex something is, it's the longer it takes. So, I see a lot of, you know, intense stares going, wow, what is this? So we can talk about it. So let's talk about the design part a little bit. I introduced some of these concepts before, but the real issue is, I don't really know what to do or what to make until I go talk to people. And we don't have speakers here, so I'm going to skip the video clip for now because you won't hear anything. But George mentioned that a while ago, and I did a session with him. It's actually over the web, but so I'm curious to know how you install Unix on our box. And he's like, why do you care about that? I can't even tell you. I just do it. So I was like, okay, let's record your steps in your terminal or in your screen and you, and I'll talk to you, and I'll ask you questions as you go through it. And one of the things that's really interesting is there's a piece where, you know, he sets up his slices on his disk that are custom, just a little bit. And so then that prompts the question, gee, George, why did you do that? And it's like, well, if I'm not the only administrator on this box in the future, and somebody doesn't really know anything but the standard install, I don't want to customize it too much because they could really be lost. And in a pinch, like we all are all the time, that would be really bad. So he's actually trying to fit down a level from the expert level to somewhere in the middle, or maybe even lower, to just say, I want to make this easier and more usable. He didn't use that term. It's my term. But, you know, that was a conscious decision. But he does it so much, he doesn't even think about how he got to that point. He also makes some really funny facial expressions. And you can see body language and other things of someone thinking really hard or they're confused and they'll never say it, but you know, they're just like, wait, what am I looking at? So you can actually see these patterns of understanding happening in real time when you do this type of study. But if I were just to ask him, like, hey, how do you do this? He probably couldn't tell me outright. So back to my earlier point, if it was a focus group, I would ask him and he would tell me something. But if I watch him, I actually see all these other things, and I go, oh, wow, he was scrunching his face and lost here, and I bet you I could figure out how to make that easier. So what then I would do is, in this case, we're looking at sysinstall, and I came and said, hey, we want to help Pavel do ZFS and sysinstall, but we don't know how to fit it in. Where does it belong? And I said, well, I don't know where it belongs until I talk to the users that use it, and they can tell me where they think it belongs. Because if I just stick it in somewhere, it's probably wrong. And you're all pretty vocal. You'll probably be pissed off. Who's the stupid guy that put this over in the corner when it should have been right in the middle or vice versa?
Yeah, I mean, just on that issue, I mean, a whole lot of things came up as I was doing install for somebody for the first time where I'm going, you know, on the one hand, you get away with this, right? On the one hand, you want the install process, no matter what the OS, to be, you know, simplified, Unix-like,
standardized,
in a simple way. Like, you're doing a task, don't do seven tasks at once, right? On the other hand, you sit there, maybe with this label, you deal with what the file system is, you know, specifically, right? Or you're breaking out the slices and partitions, and that's when you're dealing with, you know, what the file system is for, you know, partition, right? On the other hand, you also start thinking the process, like, okay, we're building a cluster of 3 boxes or 40 boxes. I know how I want, you know, the SDF to look like and how the box needs to be installed from the base, you know. I should do it once and then I should just go back to the system call man at the end and go, okay, clone this image here. And then a junior guy can come along, for instance, and go, okay, fit, 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 fit. And all they have to do is go, like, you know, boot up the CD, boot whatever, and just go, use that image, use that image, use that image. And it should, so you sit there and actually go between, you know, sophisticated, you know, individualized tasks that you want to accomplish, and on the other hand going, well, wait a minute, you know, this isn't like, I want, like, you know, one mouse click does 17 things, and taking away the beauty of actually the operating system itself. So that's really the bind you fall into. But I gotta say, I thoroughly enjoyed, you know, granted I was at Ike's house and we were having a good time, but doing this as well, learning this as well, because a lot of things you do that you don't have any conscious notion of why you're doing it or how you're doing it. He said, install 3BSD. I'm like, why? For what? You know, does VAR mail have to be its own slice? You know, there's all these things that you go through. I make a separate data slice. You know, how big this user home have to be? And so on and so forth. There's all these questions that come up when you're actually doing it in front of somebody for generic purposes.
So in this case, SysInstall is very flexible and adaptable to do any kind of customization you want, which means the first time you go through it, if you've never done it before, it's pretty confusing. You got to get out the manual or go to the site and look up the tutorial, right? Like, but the once you do it a few times, it's okay. So the learning curve initially is very steep, but then it plateaus and you're on boom, boom, boom. In contrast, buying a book from Amazon is a very linear 4 or 5 step process, and you can't deviate from it. So if you have a custom request with them, you can't do it. They just say, sorry, this is the way it works. So there's no learning curve, but there's no flexibility. So trying to use examples that I think everybody has experienced, because those are the kinds of things I design most of the time. So I have an example of what we would call an experience model. And this is not the model of George installing SysInstall, but just one from online banking. And I think everybody does online banking, so it should be familiar. But the stages you go through, usually, if you don't look at the technical part, but you look at how people experience the process for the first time, is they'll start out by looking at it and saying, what is this? You know, how is this different from my other bank, or if it's a new bank for someone? Then they spend some time researching and learning about it. So first they identify it, then they store up information so they recognize what it is and feel comfortable. And they say, okay, I'm good, I want to apply. But this comes from some other projects that I did, so I think apply is white because that was the stage they were focusing on at the time, but or it's a key stage for that project. And then once you do it, you log on, and guess what? Once you log on and become a user, you never go through this process again. Because now you jump to, I'm just going to log in and look at my account. So there's also a difference between designing something that you'll use every day over and over again versus something you'll do once. Additionally, I'll make things called customer journeys or user journeys. And a journey is someone's, well, experience going through that process, but from their perspective versus the stages of it. And in this example, we've got 4 little bobble people going through the same process, right? But you could personify them, and we'll actually make what we call personas, where we characterize archetypal user types and describe them and their family and what they do for a living and how, you know, all these things to get a feel for different kinds of people. But in this example, I just said mom, sister, brother, dad. So in my family, my mom would go to the online banking site and look at it and go, okay, I'm going to look at it. I can do this. I don't do this very often, but I'll be okay. She used to be freaked out. Now she's more, okay, I can do this. Because after 5 years of having, you know, this, I think I can feel comfortable knowing what's going to happen. And then my sister's like, yeah, I just need to do something new now. So she's always going and learning because her circumstance changes. My dad, these arrows are kind of light, but there's 3 arrows going between to learn, apply, and log on. My mom usually pitches it to my dad and says, okay, you go take care of this. I feel comfortable, but I don't want to do it. So she's still not comfortable. So it's an emotional thing, but it's also an emotional thing based on her cognitive understanding of the thing. So the better job they do designing those early stages, the better chance they have of getting more people to sign up, right? And then, if I'm the brother, I'm at the back fixing all the crap when it's broken. Right? They're like, okay, we can't figure it out. You're the technical person. Tell us what's wrong. So I end up just helping out in a pinch. So the key takeaway from this, though, is different people experience the same system differently based on what kind of person they are, what their background is, what they're trying to achieve, their comfort level, all of these different things. So Unix to Isaac will be different than Unix to George will be different than Unix to me or anyone else, because I might use it to run my Mac and dive down into the shell once in a while. Isaac lives with 50 shells open all day long. It's insane. But he can track it because
his laundry's undone. Come on.
That's getting personal. I haven't seen your screen yet. So ultimately it's about the person applying what they know and their world experiences to the thing they're looking at. So finally, this is the wrap up, and then we can get into hopefully a conversation about what the heck all this stuff is. There is a process for approaching all of this that I touched on. So I touched on the very first stage mostly, which is called research and understand, and I know this is really small. We'll post this online later and you can look at it. But there's all these things we do, right? And you go through these stages of understanding what to make, and then this interaction architect column is the area where you diagram out the flows of how people experience things, like this experience model or whatever, the customer journey. You might make some rough drawings of what it might actually look like in a user interface. And then you get into the next stage and say, yes, this is what we want to make, so let's go make it. And you actually do the user experience design and the user interface and get into the details. And when you start getting into those details, you start interacting with the technical folks that say, okay, if you want to complete this transaction, you need all of these values and these conversions between currency and whatever else you need to do, maybe that online banking example. And that's where the rubber meets the road, so to speak, because you can come up with this great concept of what it could be, and then there's this feasibility aspect of what you can actually achieve. And so then finally, the implementation column is where you build it, and then the QA column is where you verify or validate that it's going to work, and then you launch the thing. So this can happen very quickly. For me, every stage involves real people. So at every stage, I would take the design that I'm making back to that first set of users, in this case with SysInstall. I would say, okay, George, you told me, show me how you do what you do with, you know, installing Unix. Now I've tried to modify it and add DFS in, and I want you to try to do what you do and break it. Show me where it's right, show me where it's wrong, and then I'll modify it and revise it and do it again. And then hopefully by always interacting with the actual users, you make something that actually fits the way they want to use it. And that means that they'll adopt it because they like it. It makes sense to them cognitively. And then, it's much more in tune with, you know, what real needs are. So that's it. I purposely didn't show any user interfaces because I think this applies to websites, software, command line, cars, planes, airports, ATM machines.
EasyPass.
What's that? EasyPass? Yeah. Well, actually, one of the things I worked on at Sprint was putting the RFID chips in the phone so that you can buy stuff with your phone. And I've seen that that's been implemented in the subway now. But that took like 3 years. Right? So this has MasterCard on it.
Crypto with DES, 56-bit.
Yes.
World readable.
Yeah, it's kind of scary. But, so EasyPass, whatever. I think this actually applies to anything. I have colleagues that make furniture. They make, you know, software like I do. They work on cars. They work on buildings. Anything you can think of. And they can apply the same approach to making things that help people do what they do. So with that, I can go back and forth and answer questions. And I scratched the surface. Yes.
So would you make a new improved systems call?
Not yet.
Okay.
Not
what
yet.
What would be a new improved systems call?
What's that?
What would be a new improved systems call from your estimate?
A new improved systems call would be...
Totally command line, no more in-person drugs.
Well, systems call is interesting because it's kind of a graphic interface, but it's a very crude one. But it has some graphic properties to it. So I think it's also 15 years old from when Jordan wrote it, right? So actually leaving it alone is pretty important, but just fitting things in and making it not look different is probably improved enough.
Have you seen the PC you just installed?
No, I've not.
What was the question?
Has he seen the PC you just installed?
So that's another thing that is important to do, right, is go look at all of the other versions of doing basically the same thing and understand which ones are perceived to be better and why. So I saw a hand come up with this lady too.
Yes. Have you had any experience in, say, software design projects where it's actually redesign of an application that's been in production use for several years, and do you have any sort of general word of wisdom about the redesign process?
So the answer is yes, and at this stage in life, everything is redesigned. There's very rare opportunities to make something from scratch. A word of wisdom is this. So this process I described of going and spending time with people that use it is a good way to get at to answer the question, why redesign something? Usually the marketing folks at a company just feel the need to because they've got to make it new and different so they have something to sell. But if they just make it a change to make a change, it usually fails. So trying to think of a specific word of wisdom. Vista is a good example, which I did not work on, but where they changed the whole model of the way Windows works based on a fair bit of research. I have friends that do this at Microsoft, and I need to ask them, but they pissed a lot of people off because they changed too much and no one knows why. You know, it's just fine the way it was.
It sounds like Office 2007, too.
Yes.
Yeah,
ribbon stock.
It worked, but we have the people who I work with are not technically savvy.
Yeah,
so when you start changing things drastically, they get really confused. They spent a lot of effort just trying to learn it in the first place, and now everything's different.
Yeah, it becomes really hard when the product is very successful. In that case, when you have a ubiquitous product, when you change one little thing, even if it's an advanced feature for a small segment of the user base of Windows, it's still like 500 million people when you take that button away. So that's kind of nuts. So they get locked into it. So at some point they have to say, okay, we're going to break away and rethink it. And if you don't like it, you stay with the old thing. But we have to address other issues that we're being told are problems for our customers. So maybe the word of wisdom is, make sure you do the math to make sure that it's worth changing, in addition to understanding what you want to change and why. Other times, if you know it will make you more money, then you need to make more money, and it can be worth it, unless you make everybody so mad that they go on a campaign against you. And that happens. I'm trying to think. I don't want to make fun of anybody, so I won't point out to
you. But if you cook years ago,
I think New Coke is an example of, geez, we have to do something, and nobody wanted it.
They don't do too much.
And now they're just making new bottle designs, or can designs. They have an aluminum bottle now. That's not really going to make Coke taste any different, or be of more value, right? It's just kind of a gimmick. So frankly, a lot of people think that design is about the style and the form and kind of giving shape to the thing, and it's the superficial
color scheme.
George's attitude is that paint is for walls. And my attitude is that that's the final stage of something, of making it, when you add that color and that style. It's the polish that makes something feel like a real product that is really something you could use. And when you see the guts underneath, it scares you. So if your car didn't have a hood on it, your wife probably wouldn't want to drive it because she'd be like, it's broken. That's how my sister was when my car had no hood on it. Whereas I was like, I'm working on it, it's fine, because I know what's going on. So that goes back to that cognitive model stuff that I walked through, because once you become an expert of something, you know what's really going on, and structurally you're more comfortable with it. But so design can also be about designing those processes that people go through. If you're a business analyst, and you went to a business school and spent a lot of time doing process engineering and optimization and all the Six Sigma stuff, then they will really focus on streamlining things and making them more efficient. Whereas design will take the same process and say, let's completely rethink it and make a new version of it. That can happen in the other, the Six Sigma world too, but it's rare. So for me, it's not about the final shape, but it's about rethinking how to solve the problem. So, any other questions?
Yeah. There's a slide in the beginning, but I heard, but I didn't quite understand what things are. Can you explain it a little further?
I can. So, slide 7 is about measuring usability. So, if usability is how easy something is to use, so that people can buy it and do the things they want to do with it, make phone calls in this example. The way this works, it's a bell curve, and in the middle, it's 0. And if you go up towards the right, it's a positive number. If you go to the left, it's a negative number. And it's based on expectations. And I know this is kind of small. Maybe I can make it bigger.
Yeah.
Is that helpful? Okay, so if you are in the, from 0, so in this case it's 1.3, there was some math behind this that I don't know, you're meeting expectations. And because it's a bell curve, the largest volume of people are in the biggest area. So that meets expectations means that that product that you're measuring it scores among the upper 40% of all the products. And we would measure every single product or service that the company put out, and it could be compared against other products by competitors or anything else because it's a standardized measurement system. And that means that, yeah, it's pretty good. It's a good chunk of the user base is okay. If you go further up and make it really, really great product design, and it really meets the needs and they love it, you can exceed expectations, but it really only scores among the top 10% of products, which means that it's A, harder to achieve, but then B, even when you get there, it affects fewer people. So there's a return on investment drop, right? So the traditional thinking, and I alluded to the long tail, the traditional thinking is that it's not worth spending enough money to make something really great unless it's a really advanced user and it's usually a niche market, because most of the people won't benefit from that. But the long tail concept, which comes from Chris Anderson, who's the chief editor of Wired these days, this came out a while ago, talks about how all those niches can add up to actually be significant, and that when you don't have constraints like physical space, like on Barnes & Noble bookshelves, you can afford to do it. So the Amazon example is an example of this, where if they don't have it, nobody has it. But they can afford to do it because they don't have any physical space that they have to pay to keep the lights on at, other than their warehouses, which Barnes & Noble has too, so it was a gain for them. At the other end of this, it goes the same direction, only bad. So you start scoring below expectations, and then it's significantly below. And for us, if something was in that range, that was the point when we would say, okay, it's worth spending money to make it better to get it back up, because that's when people start calling customer service and complaining, and those calls are expensive, and that's bad press, so we should make it better. The other thing I would say about this, Isaac, is to move from one quadrant to the next, you can't just incrementally fix bits and pieces of, oh, you know what, that checkbox is wrong. it should be your radio button. You have to completely rethink the model or the concept of an idea, which takes me back to it's one thing to optimize a process for efficiency, and it's another to completely reinvent it. And that's hard. So for Microsoft, that would be completely reinventing Windows, or for this audience, it would be completely reinventing VST. It's hard to do. So you can do it in pieces, so then you start looking at, okay, what area should really needs an overhaul, and it can take a long time.
Fix
pain?
Yeah.
What's wrong with pain? The other thing that is a risk here that we experienced was in the time it takes for you to really rethink and then implement a new model, the market can shift and it can no longer be relevant. So welcome to the world of agile software development, where they're trying to go faster so that they can respond to the changing market needs. An example in real time of that would be, luxury items might no longer be bought right now because nobody has any money because their homes are being repossessed. So your market, if you're a product, is troubled, unless you're so far at the end that it doesn't affect you. But then you're always small and niche. But when you're spread and you're a mass market and a good chunk of your customer base is prepaid because they have bad credit and then they lose their home, you know, the phone's a lifeline, but when you can't even pay rent, you drop your phone. So that's why they're not doing well, because they chose the wrong market. So they're like, okay, this doesn't have anything to do with anything technical. I would say, though, that Unix has a market and that it tends to be advanced. And in fact, the stories that I've heard about other communities in Unix, such as the example last month was OpenBSD's installer is so hard that it's like a test, and I haven't looked at that yet either. So it's like you have to be really qualified to even get in the door with that. So because if you don't know what you're doing, we don't want you. So that self-selecting can be a niche. And that's okay. That means everybody's at a certain level. So if you do get in, and then you're in the community, everyone goes, oh, this guy has chops because he figured it out. So that can work both ways. So then that means that it's forever destined to be up here. But even with that, then you can measure it against the user base, and they can still be pissed off. And they probably will be because they are experts. So it never meets their expectations. That's a different issue. Usually. So, is that helpful?
Yeah.
I'm trying to bring this back around and characterize it, because what I try to do is figure out what to make and why, and then work with really smart people like everyone here to say, okay, how do we do it? Because everything I've experienced with those I know in the room is, you can make anything. It's like, okay, what do you want to do? Boom, it's done. So, any other questions? Yes?
Well, how do you compensate for the increasing skill level of the population? For example, if you're doing your survey on people that have some experience in products, but they're not very technically astute, you know, 2 years from now, they're going to be more technically advanced. How do you compensate for your increased skill level over time?
Can you repeat the question?
So the question is, how do you compensate for advancing skill levels over time for people that aren't necessarily technical? So they're getting better at using something, so their expectations change, but if the product stays the same, you have a problem.
Well, even if you're improving your product, I mean, how do you compensate in your development model for improved understanding of what you do?
So I'll use the PictureMail product as an example. We had this issue. So when PictureMail first came out, it was an early adopter, tech-savvy product. And because usually version 1.0 comes out, it's usually a little rough. But the tech-savvy will accept the bugs because they really want to play with the new thing. But over time, what we experienced here was, as it became, camera showed up in every single phone, suddenly people that didn't want it had it, and they said, oh, how does this work? So their expectations were totally different, but the design and the UI and everything was the same. And what we saw was, it started out being very successful at exceeding expectations, and then it very quickly went below.
It drifted
very faster than we could redesign it. The problem is that you can't design multiple versions of the same thing completely differently for different user types. So you try to, when you do the study, you get a range in your sample of participants that you ask to help you, from the expert to the novice, male, female, different ages, different, you know, backgrounds, all that stuff, and make something that works pretty well for everyone. And so you have such a significant shift where the adoption hits a saturation point where the expectations are so different that the advanced features in the way it was in the beginning have to be completely rethought. In this case, the company stopped caring about it because they were on to the next cool thing. So it just stays there and runs, and no one's really redesigning it. But unfortunately, that's usually what happens. The flip side of this is I use Photoshop, and Adobe keeps redesigning Photoshop, and I use Photoshop CS3 the same way I use Photoshop 4. I really don't care, because I have only a limited set of things I want to do with it. So they actually annoy me when they change things that I liked the way they were. So I may not upgrade, unless I have to. And actually, I have to upgrade now because my CPU changed to Intel and blah, 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 blah. So reasons I don't want to, and that actually annoys me even more. So, does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay, are there, I thought I saw more hands, but, yes?
The only book I've ever seen about usability, like computer section of Barnes & Noble, is probably like one or two web design books. People think the web page is like, you know, a piece of like a newspaper or whatever, but like, the nutshell is that people don't read web pages, they scan them. So, like, are there any like resources or books that you really like to talk about usability and the way
that you
So I'll repeat the question.
Who's that guy who did the meeting on Code Dirt Street?
Yeah, it's all like visual display of information. But it's like quantifying, that's like charts and graphs. Unpacked.
Hefty's great. Okay. The question was, are there
not
any
so much UI, not so much UI.
Are there any good resources on understanding what usability is about? And the examples in the bookstore are kind of limited about how people don't read the web pages, they scan them, and they think of them a certain way, and are they really that way? So Don't Make Me Think is a book by a person named Steve Krug. And Steve has probably the best introductory book to the concept of usability out there, which you happen to touch on. And what he mentions is similar. It goes back to this cognitive and perception stuff, where when you first look at something, you usually focus on a couple key pieces, and only after spending more time with it do you actually soak in all of it. And so you scan a book, or scan a website, you don't really read it. People tend to look in the middle first, so if you put everything way over here, they're not going to see it. Other things, Tufte, so Edward Tufte was mentioned, and yes, Isaac's right, he's all about the visual display of quantitative information and making sense of data. And that's also actually very useful for things like banking websites, or I have a friend who used to work for Web Trends, and he would make all the graphs in Web Trends, but he was good at translating the server logs and all the stuff in there and applying it to a visualization that makes sense to something that people care about. But, like, they don't want to know that the server was accessed a bajillion times, they want to know why, and so, or in what way. Let's see. There's a book on, this is a little different, and I don't remember the author, but there's a book on paper prototyping, which is a method that we use to print out the drawings that we make before we build the thing, and use that as a version of the website, and you basically put a drawing of, here's what it would be like, what would you do, and they mark the button that they would click, and they go through a process. I can look that up. Yes, Isaac, do you have one?
Christopher Alexander.
On usability?
Well, no one knows if this is a form, all the stuff. I mean,
okay.
Eric Raymond, actually, which is a big guy in
Bruce Williams world, talks about him all the time in this kind of context.
Okay. So Isaac's referring to an architect named Christopher Alexander, who's still alive and actually is at Berkeley. Go figure. And he was, in many ways, the conceptual forefather of object-oriented programming. But he wrote a book back in the late 60s. It was his PhD thesis called Notes on the Synthesis of Form. And it's about this process of thinking through how things are made and how to make them differently. That's kind of a deconstruction and reconstruction statement, not really usability, but it is about understanding how things are put together. I'm trying to think of other recent books. There's a person by the name of Jeff Beam from Adaptive Path, who's now at Google, who wrote a book called The Art and Science of Web Design, which was more about the history. It was a good history of it, but of why things became the way they were. I can try to put together a list if you're interested.
And post it.
The reality is that they get pretty academic pretty quickly, and the Crude book is one of the best ones that stays pretty high level. The model I shared with you guys tonight comes from, you know, two academics from the late 80s studying mental models. It's the book that they tell you have to buy is like $300. It's stupid. So, are there any other questions that I can try to answer? Keep them coming.
All right. How do you deal with the effect of monolithic user interface design? It seems like a lot of things are gradually moving towards, you know, the Windows-based model of how to use the computer. So, don't you think, you know, there's a left key, there's a left button on the mouse, there's a right button on the mouse, there's different things like that. Isn't there any other kind of conceptual model that's widely or better regarded for how to use Macs and so forth? But what are the other conceptual models for you?
I'll say, like, it's not just one OS or another, but for instance, how people judge an install model is usually based on Windows. A lot of Linux people don't like the in-process interface of sysinstall, OpenBSD, and NetBSD, because they're going, everything is the meter that people use, the barometer, is always the Windows install. And somehow people see that as the easiest install. It's completely backwards to assume that is the standard, but this isn't a good relevant answer, right?
Why is it the same standard, and how are other models for this?
Politics.
Politics?
One more answer.
So
that's simple.
Bobby.
That's why it's a standard. Everybody does that. You do this weird thing. Everybody does that.
Right. In 1989 or 1990, whatever, 3.1 came out of MNT, right? Whatever that was. Windows 3.0. People turned around and didn't judge on the basis of Unix standards, even though that's what was dominant, right?
Now, most of us aren't going to use Unix.
Right.
That was the legacy.
So the answer that I would give you is it's a combination of politics, marketing, culture, but then also comfort. So the ubiquity thing comes into play. So the other way to look at this model of skill-based where you're an expert, it's also based on you've done it so many times that you're an expert by default.
Okay, so that's the second question. Is the optimization based on speed, or is it based on comfort? Like, for example, this model, obviously the highest function is the skill-based behavior, which means that you're going to end up being faster at what you do.
Yes.
But is that the preferred goal for all this, or is it comfort, usability, and just feel more comfortable in certain things, even though I'm not the best?
That's a fantastic question. There's a difference between true speed and time, and then perceived speed, which can come from comfort. If it feels like it was fast because it's familiar, even though it took 20 minutes when it should have only taken 5, then it's fast enough. My original statement here, if you think of not Neo, but Michael Jordan. He was so good at what he did, he could change it up and trick the competition in real time on the fly. And there's never been anybody like it. I don't care what anybody says. He was that good. So but what you're describing in the world of comfort with Windows is a lowest common denominator factor where, because it's ubiquitous and it's sometimes the only thing people have ever known, they don't know there's a better way. But they're not good enough at it to know that they could change it up. Or it's so rigid that it doesn't offer the flexibility to do the same thing in different ways. And that's one of the problems with the, well, the installer example is a little weird because there are certain things you have to install. But one of the things that the web was really good at in, when it came in was it had simplified interacting with software, because websites are software. One click instead of two. You don't right click, you just click. It's one thought at a time, at least it used to be. Ajax is changing that. So I think that, the reason why the internet took off was because they lowered the barrier of understanding so that more people would feel comfortable.
Optimization is getting foreign from the top level.
What's that?
Foreign.
Desire.
Foreign and agile. I haven't talked about it that recently, but why not? The reason why the internet took off is that the same reason why VHS took off. Foreign. Now, like the first 15 years, that was the only profitable segment of the only commercial segment of the internet that actually made money.
So
people started doing other things, and also the reason why user interfaces were so simple on the internet was basically user interfaces were soft.
Yes. So I'll translate that into saying if you really want it bad enough, you'll figure it out. So there's a factor of desire. So desirability, viability, and then feasibility. Those are the three things. I have a diagram I didn't put in here that talks about those. Usually, the marketers are about desire, right? Then the operations guys are about viability. And then the guys that actually have to implement stuff is all about feasibility. You know, like, it's great that you want this, you know, this amazingly fast thing, but the reality is it doesn't, it just isn't possible right now. So the combination of those. If the desire for Vista was high enough because they really hit the nail on the head of what people wanted by doing what I just described, then it would have taken off. So I didn't want to do this, but I have an iPhone. This thing is taken off because there's a high demand for people to want to use their phone in a different way.
And act like they're from Soho.
What's that?
And act like they're from Soho.
Yes. So sometimes you get into culture and politics and social factors.
The poser factor.
The poser factor.
I want to be in that model.
I will also say that having worked for a carrier, this would never come from a carrier because they want to protect their model. So it comes from a new entrant, a company or an individual or a group that wants, that has a desire to change the model because they have a different goal. So, I don't know, it's... I had issues with it. Because
what is your opinion, actually, of the little the touch
how to use it,
but the little touch feature,
the touch interface? So the benefit of the touch interface is because it's all in software, it's completely malleable, and you can change anything. The downside is that you can't use it with your gloves on. You can't feel it in the dark. You can't use it if you're a user with disabilities. If you're blind. All kinds of issues that, coming from the world of, well, with this, where did it go? this concept of usability, those are factors that we would care about. And then if we didn't care about them because we wanted to do good for people in the world, because if you talk on your phone while driving and not paying attention because the phone's too complicated, you can crash it and die. It's a real issue. People then sue you if you do things like that because you were, it's called negligence. So I have issues with the iPhone because they've made trade-offs, and I think some of them are actually negligent. But maybe it's not for those users, and they would never buy one. So, but if you're going for that mass market instead of a niche, then they may not care. There's a problem if it becomes a mass market success, though. So, anyway, they don't care. They're like, who cares about buttons? This way we can change it.
Well, you know, my stepmother is difficult. He's seen things. She's not blind, but she just got an iPhone. She likes it a lot because the numbers are big.
Yes.
All other phones, she can't see what's on it.
Yes. And you can zoom in on stuff. I mean, you can make it big, mm-hmm. and other times it's really tiny. So there's trade-offs. What's your name?
Jim Brown.
Okay.
Where do you see the next 10 years of interface design? I mean, is speech language coming on, or is it tactical, or what is it?
Tactile?
That's
right.
That's what
I
do.
I don't know where to kill somebody with my iPhone.
It's neural
engineering.
Maybe. There are trends. I will not attempt to predict. It's very hard to do, but there are trends. Tactile. Touch screen interfaces are definitely big trends. Microsoft announced their Surface computer. There's a big table display. There's a, what's his name? The guy at NYU that did
Jeff
that
one.
Jeff Hahn.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jeff Hahn at NYU in their computer science department has been making wall displays where you can drag and move things around. It's collaborative, so that's really cool. Voice is hard because it happens, you have to be in a space where you can be talking to your computer and no one cares. But most of the time, you know, that actually is such an isolated event that the reality is in the work environment, it never happens. I'm usually being talked to by three different people at the same time. I'm like, please stop. But it's much more dynamic. Also, any voice user interfaces that you've experienced so far probably piss you off. And you call to ask a question to American Express or MasterCard, and you go through this computer system. It has to be so programmed that it's maybe slow to talk to a real person. So natural language recognition is still rough. I think the other thing that's been happening is that technology has been becoming more embedded in non-technical things. So your car is basically a computer on wheels. So that's a totally different interface. But now you can do a whole bunch more stuff. Go places you couldn't go because you have GPS. Beyond that, I don't think it's going to change much.
Actually, wearable computing.
Say that out.
Wearable computing. For example, the Army for its next generation soldier.
Yes.
It has like a little monocle that you put down that's equivalent to a 17-inch monitor. And like a bell pack with a mouse, or just kind of like an iPod and shit that they just talking to stuff. So for stuff like directions, getting around, Google searching, you can do that, say, and want to be texted, but you can use a more coaching. No, I'm serious, it could be
yes.
A little thing, this big, with a full keyboard, and a
quad is just glass,
everything to deal with glass.
The problem is,
it's like you're walking up there, it's a glass.
You know, the other side of glass, sure.
The challenge with wearable computing is that most of it you can do with a mobile device. So that got the cool factor, and if you need all of your hands because you're in the military and you're doing tactical procedure out in the field, then yeah, you might need to have more hands free. But a lot of it can be done here. I love that stuff, so I'm not dogging it, but it's hard.
Hold on. Basically, right now, they can do something like, say, with my glasses.
Yes.
You can put a heads-up display on. So if you do that, say, with Bluetooth, and then you have.
Yes.
Go on.
Isaac, do you have a question?
This is a question that's kind of biased, or it's kind of, whatever, I'll just kind of throw it out there. These are the Unix. This is really different and a really great lecture for this group. It's really different. These are the Unix. Fundamentally, is something that, without being arrogant or trying to dog anybody else,
just about everybody in the room here care a lot about quality. Care about being in that top little green slice, whether it's just the OpenBSD guys or not. Everybody in the room cares a lot about quality. BSD systems, we all run all incredibly stable production systems for various organizations. A lot of people in the room are around or involved in InfoSec at various capacities and with security, doing all kinds of interesting stuff. So basically what I'm getting at is a group that's interested in hardcore stuff.
Yes.
With that stated, we need these models in order to not only make more, we all are interested in doing this stuff for different reasons, but most of us do it because we like it. That's about it. That's where it starts and ends. Where does that fit into a lot of product cycles that we're talking about? Where does that kind of, because sitting in this kind of shallower part of the curve isn't what a lot of us in the room really, from the conversations we've all had for the last, I don't know, how many years around here, really, that's not where we all care to be. And it's not a lot of the projects, and I think a lot of people feel like that's a lot of what our work lives end up becoming. Given lots of bizarre demands, but where do you see markets and places in the work that you do where the kind of thing that people, that BSD people, really care about themselves? It's a really loaded and complicated question. But does it kind of make sense in a certain way? Like, I mean, because in the 80s, the joke that I get, what I'm kind of referring to historically is when Unix is dead, right? There was a moment when a certain idea of that kind of quality, that kind of...
Who's the guy that put the Craigslist thing out for a mate that likes green screens and scan lines? I saw that come across the pop list a few months ago. Do you remember that? It's like, I'm a dying breed, so I need to find a mate before I'm dead, kind of thing. Yeah, never mind. It's some guy.
Who's the Unix guy? He wants to spawn a new child.
It was really funny in a dry way. So my response to your question, Isaac, would be Unix will forever be dying, as you described it. So the only way to stay alive is to forever be innovating and pushing it forward. And because you care about quality, you will always be the bar for the others to meet, but only if you stay busy and make things better. So for all the reasons that you like it, or all the reasons why you should try to improve upon pain, right, or whatever you want to do, so now I get to challenge you later and say, when are you going to do that? And then you'll say, whenever you finish this install, right?
Yeah.
My friends are like, why would you redesign an installer? Why do you care? I'm like, well, because I want to see ZFS show up in BSD because I'm still using it. And I want to see it happen before it shows up in something else. But that's the cycle. And the problem with the people that focus on middle is that they become complacent and then they become overtaken. Right? So the things that the internet companies make should have been made by the carriers, according to carriers now. They're like, why didn't we think of that? And then you get into these other debates that this is not fair because Isaac and I have a whole dialogue, but of the carriers are the pipe and then there's the content people and it shouldn't mix. Right? You've talked about that. But if you're always focused on the one thing you know you're best at, always pushing it ahead, then it doesn't matter. If you sit around and say it's good enough, then it's game over. I don't know if I answered your question, because it was a loaded question.
But I think what you're saying is you can't move to the left in that model. You have to stay to the right.
Yeah.
Well, and then you're never going to get mass market acceptance if you don't move to the left.
Well, also zero moves over time.
So zero does move over time.
You just gave a quantifiable model. I guess what I'm getting at with this is it seems like you gave a quantifiable model to an attitude that pervades a lot of Unix culture, which is don't care if everybody doesn't get it or not. Don't care. Keep pressing. You're going to keep
So a lot of my answers to Jim's questions were about when the market changes and the adoption changes, then the expectations change. So something that's very good can slide down because too many people are using it. And I know sometimes there's a culture of exclusivity. So Prada doesn't want everybody to have Prada shoes because then you're Puma. Started out really good, and now grandmothers wear Pumas, and that's not cool anymore. Tank, right? So to some degree, you're always exclusive in your initial presentation to the public as a certain type of BSD. And then if you get accepted under the hood and somewhere else and it's rebranded or repositioned another way, then you can be a Trojan horse to be accepted for longevity, which is OS X is the example there. Right? But it took a completely repositioned approach for it to be accepted by a different audience. My mom's not going to use Solaris either, even though it has a GUI in it. Does that help?
Yeah.
And you can argue with me about it later. but no, that's a great question. There is a feel of exclusivity to it.
But I think that the BSD license is all about non-exclusivity. Like it's sort of like almost public domain. It's like you can have it who you want to say whatever, whatever. So I mean, I think there's a complicated realizing we get now is that people, we want design things so people can use them, but we're not going to cater to them to that middle degree. So what's the future, right? I mean, is there always going to be that tail on the right? I mean, that's a good question.
The tail will always be there.
Yeah.
I don't know if the license really matters because the culture and the people working on it and the things they choose to work on are what define it. Because even if you can install it, no matter who you are, if you don't have any freaking clue as to what to do with it, much less make it better, you're not a user.
Much less if you're there, reason people go open. That's why a lot of people work so hard, is that if you want to go there, you can. That's why there's all these developers out there working and making these features that only a certain small percentage of people are going to use.
The other thing that happens is that when you make a feature that seems like it's for a very specific purpose initially, and then over time people find new uses for it, that you never, as the creator, you never thought of, and suddenly it becomes adopted and for a different purpose, but it's essentially the same thing. That happens a lot. When they created the transistor, they had no idea how it was going to be used, kind of thing. So it starts out as an academic or personal pursuit, and suddenly it changes everything.
The laser printer.
Laser printer. So, you have another question into that?
Usually for the open source product, you'll see developers writing features that scratch their itch. I want this because I want this and I'll put it in. Usually commercial products, you'll find developers writing stuff that they'd really rather not do if they weren't paid. Well, no, you need to write the help, and you need to put the extra 8 steps and spend 3 days doing the stupid screen thing. But what? People are idiots. Okay, and we're paying you. And the end we're paying you gets those nice usability features for the immediate, for the zero that's not the technical community.
Right.
And otherwise, you're going to get like you say. So the open source is hard to get a usable product because somebody wants to do that work. You have to find a market.
Well, I think that the flip side of that is that, in the green section, you have people who are more concerned that, it's really up to their specifications. But if you have something like the commercial model, where you have, whether Red Hat or Solaris, they will cover, something, on an enterprise level, but, it has to be, nobody really wants to do this, but we're going to do it anyway because our customers are demanding it. But at the same time, they're driven by market forces. And so they're never going to go past 1.2 or 1.3. It doesn't make sense to their stockholders for them to make it 99%. Good enough is good as they're going to get.
They're in business.
Yeah. And if you want to bring that Barcelona to make a really custom high-end stuff, they have a program that will do it. So there's any other, even Microsoft, if you give them enough money, they'll spend you a great deal with them. They're a business. You wave enough money that they don't get interested. But the problem with the open source is that the developers generally, they write to scratch their itch, they write to scratch the itch of their friends. What they don't generally do is write for the median of the average user. It's not fun. It's of no value to the developer personally, unless he's trying to get his mom involved. You know, it's just, there's no incentive, as there is in the commercial world, that we pay you to do this. Why did we pay? It was fun. We could pay you less money. You know, please do it. Like anyone who's got a contract work. I had a job. We pay you to do this, but it's not fun. That's why we pay you. We pay you to show up when you're sick. We pay you because we wake you up at 2 in the morning. We pay you because all these things are not fun. Otherwise, the job would be worth much less money. It's the beast. You know, it's like you used to get pulled out at 2 in the morning.
Yes.
And they paid you for that.
Yes.
And they didn't pay you for that. You were told them, you know, they were saying, that's your call, start calling at 2 in the morning. You went out and found a job that either paid you for it or did you do it?
Well, not there anymore.
Exactly. See?
There are still people here. So
Hopefully it's social.
Sometimes. So there's another way to look at this. I don't have a direct response because you're right, but you can look at it as the whole market. Yeah, I just said you're right. So there's the whole market, right? And a lot of the open source and the Unix stuff is in this niche area that's advanced and expert users. But if you were to measure it just against yourself, suddenly all those good experience and things that you make because you wanted to scratch an itch, you come in the middle.
Yeah.
Because you're not caring about this other stuff.
Yes.
So if I were to actually apply this, that's probably what I would do. I would just measure all these things that are being made and say, are they meeting your expectations of what you set out to make?
Yeah.
And just not worry about it because it's a specific audience.
Yeah. But that's why you don't get the general audience. Yeah. Most of the successful general audience things. You find someone who is, for whatever reason, willing to do all of that stuff that just, you know, they say this, God, why are people unwilling to learn? Why can't they read the directions? Why can't they do this? But still, generate the 8 screens of stupid little steps. You know, that kind of thing. And commercial software has the advantage of that they can be paid to do this.
And they still do a pretty bad job.
Yeah, but they do. Even if it's not. It may not be great, but there are the 8 screens. And you don't have to educate the consumer when they call in. You say, okay, get to screen 1. Put this in. Hit next. Put this in. Hit next. Dot. Done. Thank you. Have a nice day. Please call in. You know, cool. If you give them something where you say, well, you have to read this 10-page article and figure out, you know, the options you want to use.
Yep.
You know, which I'd rather do than make a tech support call. But I'm weird. You know, they won't do it. They'll be a nightmare. He'll be in my ear because the poor guy, he doesn't have a script. It's horrible all around.
Any other questions, comments? Or anybody feels ready for beer?
Second beer. Wow.
When we get out.